Can we start off with your first memory about affordable housing? Why is this, when did this become important to you?
So the term affordable housing really wasn't known to me until I was 21 years old when I got my first job at an organization that provides affordable housing. But truly affordable housing is really the reason why I'm sitting here today and why I've had any of the opportunities that I've had in life. So when I was 2 years old, my family moved from Des Moines, Iowa to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and we bought and lived in what we called, and we still do, a trailer and a trailer park, now often referred to as manufactured housing, in a manufactured home community. But when I look at what, you know, the purchase of that 1968 model single wide trailer, which we subsequently moved to a farm in Colfax, Wisconsin, you know, what that meant for what we were able to do, even though we were a very low-income family. My father then died just a few years later. What that allowed my mom to do, it allowed her to go back to college. Eventually, she sold the farm, and we moved to more affordable housing in the Twin Cities metro area. So while I didn't name it at that point, and I didn't quite realize what it meant, I look back now and I think, gosh, that's really the place where I found rest, which we talked about last night, acceptance, and stability that, you know, I draw on.
When you think of the work that you do at Common Bond Communities, how do you define affordable housing at the organization today?
Sure. So, I think there's a lot of interest in a technical definition of affordable housing, and I'm here to tell you that there are many, and the technical definitions really mostly have to do about who the housing is targeting and how much of their income a government entity, typically, has deemed appropriate for them to pay for that housing. So most of our federally supported affordable housing deals will serve folks in this region that would make a family of four that would make $40,000 or less a year. And they would pay 30% of that ideally toward rent. But let's set aside that technical definition because it is terribly arbitrary. It varies from program to program and it changes over time, right? You know, 50 years ago, it was considered affordable to pay 25% of your income to rent. Now it's 30. There are proposals for some folks that it would go to 35%. Some people in this room probably pay much less, and some people in this room probably pay much more as a percentage of their income. But I also think about different aspects of affordable housing. You know, I think in this country, we have some minimum expectations for quality. And those are reflected in minimum building codes and standards. Different municipalities will layer on top of state norms, you know, what is really considered to be fit for human occupancy. So there's this idea of quality for the person or persons living in the home. But for me, there's also this sense of being connected to a community. Whether it's, you know, in a rural community context or whether it's in a city like Rapid City. To me, there's this, the bigger than the physical product itself concept of affordable housing that I think is really terribly important.
Thank you. You talked a little bit about the history and the change of affordable housing. So the question I have is, affordable housing has been in the news, all we have to do is Google it, and there are 12 stories today written from coast to coast that are in the media. It's discussed here locally and throughout the country.
So much of our
And Siri says, maybe not. So much has been talked about, so much has happened over the last 50 years or more that has brought this country so much wealth and prosperity, and the American dream that has lasted a car, or a house, a car, X amount of kids, et cetera, et cetera. In a time when the stock market is as high as it is, unemployment's as low as it is,
why?
Yeah. Why do we have this affordable housing issue?
Yeah, it is remarkable. So I've been in this business over 25 years now, which kind of freaks me out, but it's true. I was on a panel yesterday with a mentor, former boss, and the commissioner of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, who's been in the business a few years longer than I have. And she made the comment that never in her professional career has housing been the affordability and access of housing been on the minds and tongues of just regular people. It's always been this kind of, you know, policy nerd kind of territory. And I definitely feel that. I mean, every community I go to, people on the street, you see, you know, letters to the editor and papers. And I would say there's a few things. It is true that people at various income levels are feeling the pinch of the limited supply of housing. So I heard last night that in Rapid there's been diagnosed a need kind of at the lowest income bands but also at higher income bands for housing. We're definitely seeing that in all the communities we work in, particularly communities that have strong economic bases, that there is a need across the spectrum. So that kind of helps the cause and the visibility of the importance of affordable housing when you have people who are making six-figure incomes and they're really not finding places to live. That tends to, you know, broaden the constituency. But I think there's another really important factor to recognize, and that's that when we look over our recent history, we're seeing a growing differential between where housing costs are going and where incomes are going. So I don't have a stat for this region, but I have a stat for the Twin Cities that I'll share with you. And this is repeated in a lot of areas where I've been able to find the data. So in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, over the last 10 years, inflation adjusted, rents have gone up 9%, and incomes have gone down 11%. So that's a 20% differential. So if you started out 10 years ago being able to comfortably afford your rent, and you're working in the same kind of job that you were working in 10 years ago, and you're living in the same kind of housing that you were living in 10 years ago, you're feeling 20% more pain, basically. And this phenomena is repeated in most communities. And so that, I think, is why, you know, kids who are done with college and they're in their first job or they're starting a family, you know, they're not finding the kind of housing opportunities that I had when I graduated from college, where I could conceivably pay my student loan debt and rent and, you know, save for a car. And, you know, I mean, these kind of things are slowly and slowly going out of reach, I think, of most people.
Will you discuss common bond communities?
Sure.
Will you share about your organization? How would you describe it?
So I'll answer it two ways. So at Common Bond, you know, we really believe that communities are stronger when we all have opportunity to pursue goals and aspirations. And so that doesn't sound like it's anything about housing, but it's actually all about housing. We know that people can pursue goals and aspirations and focus on things that are important to them if they have the stability of an affordable home. And so because we know that's true, we build and we manage homes, rental homes, for what's now over 12,000 people in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. We work in 56 cities, and we offer a variety of housing situations, everything from units in a sixplex building in South Minneapolis to 640 units in a tower. A full range for all kinds of folks, seniors, families living with children, individuals, you name it. So we know that once someone is stably housed, when that piece can be managed in their life, that's when services can assist a family in achieving what they where they want to go in their life, right? So once someone has a rent that's manageable in a place that's decent, that's when they can start to say, well, let's work with a financial counselor and save up for that first home. Or if they're a senior, let's make sure that I'm focusing on my health and wellness so that I don't have to go to a nursing home at the end of my life. If it's with kids, let's identify those kids that are starting farthest behind in reading and math, and let's focus energy and attention and good academic programming around them so that they're better able to succeed. So that's the kind of why we do what we do, and we've been doing it since 1971. The organization was started by a group of kind of activist Catholics at the St. Paul Minneapolis Archdiocese. We're no longer associated with the church, and in fact we work with all sorts of faith communities and secular communities to build and program in our housing. But I do feel really good that we've stayed very close to the original values of those folks, because they were people who saw what was going on in the U.S. at the time, in the late 60s in particular, and really wanted to actually do something to make the cities that they cared about stronger.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
What do you enjoy most of your work?
What do I enjoy most about my work? The thing I love most is when I go to a site and I get to talk to somebody who lives in one of our housing communities. And this is going to sound funny, but I love it when they complain to me. this isn't the most fun, but I love it, because what it means is that this person feels enough power and agency in their home, in their housing, that they're willing to come up to, you know, the big scary CEO. That's what I look like, right? Most people are looking for, like, who my boss is when I walk in. They're like, when is the CEO going to get here? Well, actually, it's me, so, you know. And then they'll say, well, you know what? This, you know, common room furniture is really getting pretty drab. And, like, we need some more, you know, we need a new couch around here. Or, gosh, you know, the snow wasn't plowed fast enough after that last storm, and it was a real inconvenience. I actually take that as a sign that those folks really feel like that's their home and that they're going to hold us accountable for doing a good job, which to me, that's really satisfying, because it's more than just being, you know, the kind of stereotypical image of someone who's, you know, grateful for the opportunity or what have you. It really, I think, indicates a positive power relationship.
You shared a story last night about the beginnings of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
Would you share that this morning?
Want me to cry again?
No. But if you do, there's Kleenex over there.
All right. I guarantee you I will cry. As I said, you know, we were started by a group of folks active in the Catholic Church, who, you know, at the time were really frustrated with both religious and secular society and its inability to address the distress, particularly in urban communities. And, you know, and so that's the context. A couple years ago, I had a visit from one of the gentlemen who was involved in the ideation, like the whole origin of our organization. It was a hard time for me. It was a really difficult moment for us in St. Paul. It was right after the Philando Castile shooting, and if people weren't familiar or have forgotten, it was the shooting of a motorist, black motorist, by a white police officer in a suburb of St. Paul. And there were some connections between folks at Common Bond Communities, both staff and residents, and Philando and his family. And so it was all really raw. And we were trying to figure out how to be talking about these things and how much to be talking about them. And I was just feeling really stressed and depressed by this whole situation. And so in comes this guy, and he's a very elderly gentleman. And he came in, and we hadn't met before. I'd known his name. You know, he's kind of part of the lore of the organization. And he came in, and he was telling me about the conversations that were the birth of our organization. And he was talking about, you know, voter registration and integrating schools and, you know, all of the social justice work that they were involved in. And I was so low at the time, and I just said to him, I'm like, I don't know how you went on. You know, it must have been so exhausting. You know, I was really projecting on him what I was feeling at that moment. And he turned to me, and he put his hand on my arm. I'll never forget it. And he said, oh, no. Actually, Deidre, I've never felt more alive. He said, in those moments, that's who you prove who you really are. And so that was the kind of pep talk I got from one of the founders of our organization. And then it was great. I didn't say this last night. He proceeded to tell me and list off the names of all of these citizens of St. Paul and Minneapolis who were involved in these conversations early on, some of whom were not Catholics. And I knew all of them. And it was really fascinating to me that all of these people who are well-respected leaders in our communities, some of whom have passed on, were part of the start of our organization. And I didn't even know that. You know, I thought I'd really known this organization my whole career. So it was really great.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. What do you suppose are the most important characteristics of those leaders that started what is Common Bond Communities?
What I saw expressed, the leadership that I saw manifest in those folks, I would say there's a humility, first of all. So these were people who really had incredible strengths, skills, connections in the community, influence socially and economically, but they were willing and interested and motivated to be involved in improving other people's lives, and approached it in a way that was definitely of service, but also was with a deep and genuine desire to hear and respond to the needs of communities. You know, which isn't always the case, right? Mm-hmm. So this idea that they didn't have all the answers, mm-hmm. But they were willing to try to find them with the people that they wanted to serve, I think that was a common thread. And also, just real tenacity. I mean, at that time, it was a different landscape politically and economically and with regard to housing programs. And you know, they were going to just figure it out, something out. And they worked pretty hard for a long time before they had a first win.
Do you think those same characteristics and attitude toward this work hold true today in leadership?
We talked a little bit last night about the professionalization of the field. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that and this is, you know, painting way too broad a brush, you know, I think as our field has professionalized, there's been a lot of good that's come out of that, but there might be a little more emotional distance and accountability distance that's crept in, which, you know, maybe is not ideal. Mm-hmm. And I think it takes conscious effort on the part of folks who do the work we do to keep a real open dialogue going with communities we're trying to serve. And when I say communities we're trying to serve, I don't only mean the people we house, but I mean the communities around those housing developments. And that's hard work. That's probably the hardest work we do.
Your work is in three states, mm-hmm. Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, mm-hmm. 56 communities, 56 cities, towns, over 12,000 people. Is there a community that's doing something exceptional in your mind within all of that that stands out to you?
Every community is the same.
What do you mean?
In most ways. Okay. Meaning, when you go to talk about affordable housing in virtually any city, the same themes come up.
What are those things?
The themes are, there's so many, but the themes are about, you know, cost of land, access to land, cost of construction, access to labor, those things that get in the way of production. It's also, common themes are about, and this is a really strong narrative everywhere in the U.S., the superiority of ownership over rental, I understand that home ownership is how most Americans build assets, absolutely. But I believe that there is a moral undertone to that conversation that is present in every community I've worked in. It's starting to change a little bit now in denser communities like the Twin Cities, but really, it's still strong there. And I think there's also a tendency to want to remove the conversation from one's own self, right? To be able to say, let's talk about affordable housing because it's important for those people, like as an act of charity or what have you, or an act of protection, right? To avoid civil issues or crime issues or whatever it is. So those are common themes that come up in the discussion around affordable housing. And I would say in the siting of affordable housing, many of these discussions end up being a pretty thin cover for issues of race and class. So that's true everywhere. And I think a lot of that is just about human nature. What I see, which is really interesting going on in a few communities, is willingness to bring those conversations forward in a really public way and to act slightly differently than we have in the past. And I'll give just a couple of examples. City of St. Louis Park in Minnesota, their city council has taken quite a bit of heat and really brought into their council discussions and in policy that they've enacted protections for renters. And this is a community that's it's a first-ring suburb, fully developed. They're going through a redevelopment, period. A lot of their stuff was kind of mid-century, right? And so now they're going through and they're adding density and they're adding rental and they're adding retail, which means they're adding, congestion and parking and, all of this stuff. So everyone loves the amenities that density brings, and they don't like the downsides, which, of course, who does? But they're really getting out there to do things like require anyone who's selling a multifamily rental building to have to give advance notice to tenants so that if you're going to be displaced because your apartment building got sold, you at least have 90 days to prepare yourself. And, 90 days is probably not enough for some people, but it sure is better than 30, right? So actions like that, I think, are really interesting. The city of Milwaukee has, in some areas of the city, a completely different problem. They have a lot of abandoned properties and vacant land. So they're taking action to try to find reuses for abandoned properties. And there's a really cool program called Strong Blocks there, which is a small organization, but they're doing really cool work to use local labor and local contractors to renovate and make available for really affordable ownership single-family homes and duplexes in Milwaukee. So there's cool stuff going on everywhere. As much as we have these common themes and seemingly intractable issues, I also see these glimmers of hope of people saying, okay, we're going to think differently about it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. What do you believe is the greatest challenge to our society?
Just a small question. This is why he brought two cups of coffee. I'm not even through the first one yet. We're hearing more and more about this now, so I'm not going to seem profound or super smart by calling it out. But, you know, I think income and wealth inequality is absolutely at the root of so many of the issues that we deal with. And it is absolutely the challenge of our next century, I believe. Racial and ethnic disparities in that, which are not the same, but they're closely aligned, are, I think, huge problematics for us.
Would you describe the average tenant?
So the average tenant of a common bond community is, it's really hard to say. So I'd like to create a couple of different profiles instead. So 12,000 people, you can imagine, right? Any group of 12,000 people is going to have a lot of diversity in it. But I'll give you some ideas. So first of all, the average income of a common bond household is $21,000 a year. That's across all of the folks that we serve. And the average household size is 1.7. Those numbers might seem pretty low to you, and I would say that the primary reason for that is when you average everyone out, we serve a lot of seniors who tend to be single women who have even lower incomes. So that's where our household size and our income tends to skew even lower on average than you might assume. But just by way of illustration, in our senior developments, it's almost predominantly single women. We have only 50 of our senior households that have a couple, that have more than one person in the household. And that's out of almost 2,100 units of senior housing. So that's something that I think probably reflects everyone's own personal experience. The average income of a senior in our developments is $16,000 a year. So most of the seniors we serve are, you know, well beyond working age. We do serve younger seniors, but who are still working, many of them. But for the most part, our seniors are no longer working, and they're dependent almost exclusively on Social Security income. And in order to qualify for many of the senior units we have, these folks have zero assets. They're limited to less than $3,000 worth of assets. So just think of, you know, how little $3,000 is, right? So that's a senior profile. We serve a lot of families. That's the kind of biggest population. And we use the term family, you know, pretty loosely. In any of our rental units that have more than one person, we define that as a family unit. They may not be a family unit. They may be unrelated. But we have about 3,400 kids that live in common bond communities. And in those units, the vast majority of people are working. And they're probably working more than one job. And they're more likely to be headed by a single head of household, so a single mom or a single dad, usually a single mom. And so the housing that we provide to those folks is really what makes it possible for them to support a family and to give stability to their kids. Over a period of time. Third profile, and then I'll be done. The third profile are folks that live in our, what we call supportive housing. So this is housing that comes with a true set of wraparound services that's available 24/7. For the most part, these are folks that have mental, chemical, and physical health issues that make it extremely difficult for them to maintain housing elsewhere. Virtually all of them have had an experience of long-term homelessness, as defined by the state, which is, I won't even bore you with the definition, but people who have legitimately experienced a long period of homelessness or recurrent homelessness periods over time that indicate their challenge in trying to live in a stable environment. And so for those folks, you know, the services that we provide are, they're aspirational, but they're aspirational in a different way, right? It's really about maintaining basic stability in life and the ability to live in community with others. And the most kind of high-profile development for that population that we've done is Upper Post at Fort Snelling, which is for previously homeless vets and their families. So really helping folks who have challenges re-entering after doing service to our country.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So with 12,000 people, how would you define success for the folks that are tenants or a part of your organization? Is it to move people on to beyond affordable housing?
So again, because we serve so many different people at different places in their lives, I would say my shorthand is that success is when people move on only when they move up. For many of the folks we serve, you know, most notably seniors, there's really no better place for them to be. Most of the seniors that leave us either pass on or they move into an assisted living environment or a memory care facility, something that indicates, you know, a degradation of health and well-being. And so so for that population, I'm really proud to say that the average senior lives with us for 8 years and that that number has gone up. I actually see that as a success. But there are plenty of folks that live with us at Common Bond Communities who live with us, you know, for a year or 3 years or 6 years on their way to something else, whether it's on their way to being able to afford a market rate apartment, whether it's on their way to move to a different community where they've found employment that they feel like represents opportunity for them, whether it's moving on to home ownership. There's another place that they go that in their own estimation is better than a Common Bond community. To me, that's success. When people feel like they can have the support they need as long as they need it, and also know where they're going when they leave, and know and be excited about where they're going when they leave.
Deja, I really, it was wonderful to hear you talk about, 6 years seems like a really long period of time. But as you described the impact on children, the multi-generational aspect of what you do and how important that is to for a healthy society, what it can mean, that was really educational for me. Would you share a little bit about that?
Sure. So the average length of stay at a Common Bond family property is about 6 years. And I oftentimes get questions, well-intentioned. People want to make sure that we're really being good stewards of the donations that we get and of the government resources that we use. So people often ask, you know, how are you making sure that people aren't taking advantage of this resource or living there too long, right? This implication that people need to be motivated from the outside to leave our housing communities. And I tend to talk I tend to talk not so much about the adult in the household as I do about the kids in the household So, you know, if we're supporting a single mom in having her kids live in a common bond community for, I don't know, maybe a couple years longer than they needed to, in somebody's estimation, right? I'm not so much worried about that. I'm not worried about what it does for the mom, you know, her motivation, whatever. I happen to think that people are generally pretty well self-motivated. But I try to make the argument about the difference the stability makes in that child's life and how, as a society, investment in that stability is actually the best use of those dollars we could make. So, you know, there's a ton of data and research that shows that kids that move frequently do worse in school. They're less likely to graduate from high school. They're way less likely to go to college and succeed. So if we can get the next generation of kids in a place where they can make genuine connection, where they can have the stability and the predictability of being at the same school from kindergarten to sixth grade, that's amazing. If we can keep them in the same school from kindergarten to 12, like, that's magic elixir. And so, you know, I really try to focus on what is the housing, the access and the affordability of the housing and the reduced stress in those families, what is all of that doing for the next generation? Not to write off the current generation, but to really say, you know, we oftentimes focus on the adults. Are the adults worthy of our investment? Are they working hard enough to justify our co-investment in their stability? Find, ask those questions, but let's also recognize that we're really investing in the kids.
Thanks. Thanks for sharing that. You've talked a little bit about folks that started this organization. You've shared in different conversations people that you have gotten to know over the years in this field of work. I'm wondering about mentors. I'm wondering about people that have influenced you.
Yeah.
Would you share
Sure.
a little bit about one or two of them?
So some of you met a couple years ago Kelly Lindquist, who came through town, who is an incredible friend and mentor to me, who runs Art Space Projects, which is where I had my first job in this field, which I tripped into accidentally. And he's really inspired me in a lot of ways. And he was the person who kind of taught me the value of vulnerability in leaders. You know, this idea that a leader doesn't have to be someone who has every answer and can do it all themselves. It has to be somebody who can compel others to work toward a common goal. So I value his mentorship quite a bit. More recently, a gentleman by the name of Dick Brewstead passed on in January of last year. He was a senior partner in a firm that I worked in that was a for-profit organization, but perhaps the most values-driven for-profit that I'd been exposed to or have any, you know, knowledge of. When I worked, it was called Brighton Development, it's no longer active really, but when I worked for Brighton, I saw the partners there repeatedly make decisions that were against their financial interest in order to do something that they thought was better for the community or better for residents. And they have made a remarkable physical impact on the city of Minneapolis, reviving the mills along the riverfront for some of the highest income earners in that community, but they also did a lot of affordable housing, which I got to focus on when I worked at that organization. And so he was such a principled person, and the one thing I always think about when I think about Dick Brewstead is he said, don't do more than three stupid things on any deal. And I use that all the time at Common Bond. I'm like, okay, you know, let's get clever, but let's not get too clever so that it crumbles under its own weight. And along with Dick, he had two, and they survive him, two women partners, Peggy Lucas and Linda Donaldson. And, you know, for me as a woman of my age, working with women a couple decades older than me that were really pioneers in real estate, which is a male-dominated industry, they were incredible and remain incredible mentors to me.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. In addition to don't do three stupid things in one deal, Is there a piece of advice that you think about? Or what's the best piece of advice that has
that
been given?
I would give?
That
I've been given?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, another one is pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered. You know, a lot of the work that we do, the side of the work that we do that I actually find the least pleasure in is amassing resources from anybody and everybody who has a dollar that they're willing to contribute to the effort, right? Housing is the most expensive intervention that we can think of. It has the best payback and the most generational and lasting, multi-generational and lasting payback, but the dollar amounts are staggering when you talk about what it costs to build a unit of housing. And so it's a constant game of going to government sources, going to foundations, going to individuals, you know, and trying to convince them that this is worth their investment. And finding that right place where we're doing what we should, what we can, we're satisfying the demands of lenders, the demands of communities for the type of quality, et cetera, that that we need to provide. And realizing that it's not a bottomless pit of resources, and to try to walk this line of good stewardship of resources, doing something that we're all proud of, and making sure that the value that's delivered for that money that's contributed and invested, you know, is commensurate.
Mm-hmm. Is there a piece of advice that you've given?
I tend to get a lot of questions about people from people who want to make a career in this space, mostly because I have been teaching now for the last 7 years, folks who are in graduate programs that relate to this field. And so I get a lot of advice about, you know, kind of how do I get from where I'm sitting in my seat at Humphrey Institute or the Graduate School of Design to where you are. And I guess the piece of advice I give people is to use a compass, not a map. I think one of the temptations of human beings is to try to chart a linear course from A to B. And I think, you know, that works for some people, right? If somebody wakes up and they're, you know, a kid and they know they want to be a doctor, and they can follow a pretty clear path to being a doctor. But I think for most of us who want rich and fulfilling careers that make a difference outside of our own family, being open to a detour or two, being true to that, you know, the north, the magnetic north of your own values and spirit, but being open to where a side path might take you, hence the, you know, compass not math analogy. You know, I think that's great advice for life and great advice professionally, regardless of field, mm-hmm. not necessarily related to affordable housing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
What's the biggest challenge that you face in the work that you do? Take money out of it.
Me personally or our organization?
You personally.
Huh. The biggest challenge I face personally, I'm going to answer both, can I?
Yes, okay. Of course.
The biggest challenge I face personally is, you know, we're a pretty large organization and we're pretty far flung, 380 staff people. The biggest personal challenge I face is that I can be in a grocery store with a member of the Common Bond team and not even know it. You know, I don't know everybody who works for Common Bond personally. I don't necessarily recognize them, and I certainly don't know all of their names. And that's really hard for me. I've had the luxury in my previous work life to have to be able to exercise a different kind of leadership that's really about personal relationship. And so this role for me, which is a little bit more removed from a lot of the people who do the hardest work in our organization, which is on the ground with residents. That's the most personal, intense work. That's hard for me. It's a struggle. As an organization, I think our greatest challenge is really identifying communities that are truly receptive to affordable housing. It's a rare opportunity where we will identify a site where there isn't community opposition. And that's, I think, it's tough psychologically for staff. It also adds cost to our developments. It adds delay. You know, it slows our process. From start to finish, if we do a federally subsidized affordable housing deal, a fast timeline is 3 years. It's not unusual at all for it to take 5 years. And a lot of that we can attribute directly back to moving through barriers to entering communities. So I would say those are the two levels of that answer.
Is your work, do you view your work as a career, as a vocation, as, how do you describe your work? Is it a vocation or is it a career that you?
I think yes and yes, and you know, work-life balance is not a strong suit of mine. So when I think about like what is my work, or what is this thing I do with whatever 50, 60, however many hours a week, I don't really think about it as being separate from who I am. So I just think it's just, you know, what I do, who I am.
Mm-hmm. You shared a story about how Kalamban communities entered into providing services and helping coordinate services, if I understand correctly. Mm-hmm. In your 56 communities that you are working in the three states, you help facilitate and coordinate over 100 service providers and also provide services. That started with a really interesting story. Will you talk a little bit about that?
And
and do I have it correct that you were one of the first organizations to not only develop, but also property manage and provide services?
Yep, that's okay. Absolutely true. So, you know, a lot of our identity is a real estate, an affordable housing real estate developer, right? And that tends to be kind of how people think about Kalamban communities. But that's actually, I think, not doing great justice to what our value proposition is, if you will. So absolutely, it's good and hard work that has to be done to build and acquire and rehab housing. And that was where we started. But very shortly after we started in that work, the organization realized that, you know, really what matters is good property management, because that's what makes the building that you build an asset to the community around it and a great place to live in for the people who are residents. And so the organization started very early on providing its own property management. And then shortly after that, it was actually the receptionist at Kalamban that went to the founding CEO, a guy named Joe Arago. And she said, Joe, you know, I get calls all the time from people who need something other than just the housing. And she was giving him examples of the kind of hiccups people have in life, you know, and a lot of us are lucky to have a friend or a family member or a sibling that they can go to say, you know, I have to file for unemployment. How do I do this? Or I want to save to buy a car. You know, what's my best? How do I do that? She said, you know, people could do a lot better than they're doing if they got just a little bit of extra help. And so that's how services started at Kalamban, which was just kind of listening to the need and recognizing the potential and then responding to it. To Joe's credit, he's like, all right, well, why don't we do that for a while? Let's see what that looks like. And so we started, among our peers, organizations that do this similar kind of work, we were some of the earliest to provide services of all sorts to residents in our communities.
A couple more questions before we wrap up. As we were walking here from the Alex Johnson Hotel, I think I was sharing with you that I wish I would have made a list of do's and don'ts and asked you about it. Do this, don't do this, do this, don't do this. What's one do and what's one don't when looking at creating affordable housing in any community?
Yeah. So I'll answer it slightly differently. I think there are some things that get prioritized or get more focus than they're due. There's, you know, when we start talking about doing an affordable housing development, you know, all the conversations, I guarantee you, start with a site. Oh, you know, we're going to find just the right location, we're going to find just the right building, you know, whatever that looks like. There's a lot of focus on the real estate, and it is a real estate activity, so I get that. But there's an undue focus on that. You know, in some communities, really not most of the communities we work in, is it impossible to find a site, right? And certainly in a community like Rapid City, you have land available. It's, you know, probably not the place to start. I'll go back to the biggest challenge. The place to start is to make sure that the local community understands what its needs are and understands the benefits that accrue beyond the people who will actually live in the building of the development of that affordable housing. The fact that, you know, affordable housing is actually part of civic, social, economic infrastructure, right? If you don't have places that are affordable for the people who work in your tourism industry, it will get harder and harder and harder for that segment to grow. We see this really profoundly in communities we work in greater Minnesota and greater Wisconsin where they have dominant employers, right, where you might have one or two employers that employ, you know, a majority of residents. That's when you really start to see a clear connection to economic development and affordability and access to housing. So back to the do, you know, do worry about what the actual needs are. Understand them to a greater extent than most of us do, right? Who is it that has the need? What is the nature of their need? And then try to respond to that.
I was going to ask, what's your piece of advice for Rapid City, but I think you just gave it. Is there a resource that you would recommend a community like Rapid City that is talking about affordable housing? Is there a resource that you would recommend it look at?
In the form of a text that tells you how to do everything you need to do?
I don't know if I would go there, but...
First of all, there is no book that tells you exactly how to do it. I guarantee I was looking for it because I've been teaching this class, and I was thinking, oh, good, I'll just go get that textbook, and I'll teach from the textbook. And it turns out that there aren't many textbooks about this. There's one called Developing Affordable Housing that does a pretty good job, but it's from a financial perspective primarily. I would say the resources that I would depend on and that, you know, we do depend on are experienced developers, so folks like Common Bond, folks that do work in your own communities who understand the real estate side, because obviously that's a big piece of it. Organizations that mobilize and represent those that have the need you're trying to fill. Oftentimes there's, you know, those folks are not seen as a resource or an important part of the conversation, and they absolutely should be. The resource of government is absolutely essential in this space. even if you did a completely unsubsidized affordable housing project, like let's say you had a, you know, benevolent billionaire that wanted to just, you know, pay the entire cost of building affordable housing in Rapid City, you absolutely still need units of government for that to succeed, to give you the approvals you need, potentially to support folks, you know, through the county services or what have you, that may have higher needs than what you're able to do. So those are resources in your own community that are absolutely essential. And then, you know, the nice thing about the affordable housing community nationally is that there are a ton of people who do this as a business, for-profit and nonprofit, who are competitors with one another, who are also supportive of doing more of this work. The nice part about that is that, you know, you could call a common bond, you could call one of the for-profits that do this, and they're not going to see you as competition, right? For market. I mean, there is more need and demand for this than we can possibly address. What there is some competition for is resources. But for the most part, people I have found are really generous in this industry, in advice about how to navigate federal programs, in advice about how to keep construction costs low. And I can certainly provide some recommendations of some of those networks and organizations that would be good resources.
Thank you. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule, taking the travel here to spend yesterday and today with us. One of the things as you're just sharing this morning and at the end there is we've just had a whole hour conversation, and I don't think we talked about homeless. I don't think that came up. And I just think that's just interesting in all the conversations that are happening here and how much that comes up. We have a piece of artwork that we would like to give to you. The artist is Mindy Elliott. Mindy is an artist at Black Hills Works Susie Kappa Art Center, an art center and studio for persons of all abilities. We hope this finds a place on a wall and you remember your time in Rapid City.
Oh, I love it.
Thank you
Isn't
for
great?
Taking
Thank
time
you.
With us today. So, a couple announcements.
Can I have permission to take a picture of the crowd? Because I have to show that I wasn't just taking off for the weekend.
A long weekend?
See, I told you it was a real thing. This is great. Love it. Thank you.
So a couple announcements. I want to say special thanks to Dalton, who every month has come in and help get the chairs, bring them here, help set up every month. He does this. He graduated from School of Mines. He took a position in Hawaii, and he will be leaving here. Dalton is next to Pastor Wilbur, so we can embarrass him here. Sam Outlaw is going to play here. He's a South Dakotan. He'll be here June 6th. He moved to L.A. He plays all over the world. He's bringing a special guest, Molly Pardon from Nashville. Please join us on June 6th. And tomorrow night, we're going to have an art reception with Bill Grothy, who will be speaking, as almost everybody in this room knows who he is. And he'll be sharing some of his thoughts and about his work over his lifetime. So please join us tomorrow at 5 p.m. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Peter.
Yeah, that was fun.